Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome everybody to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco and our listening audience nationwide. The club can be found on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Allison Gopnik, and I'm a developmental psychologist and professor at the University of California at Berkeley and also a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. And I'm very happy to be your moderator for this program on a topic that's near and dear to me, both professionally and autobiographically, successful aging. And especially glad to be here with my old, very old friend in both senses, Dan Levitin, who's the author of the new book, Successful Aging. And as many of you know, Dan is the best-selling author of several books, including This Is Your Brain on Music, and apparently now another bestseller, because the book is on the bestseller list. Dan started out as both a neuroscientist and actually a professional musician, but now he's turned his attention to how our brains develop over our lifespans and how we can think differently about the last decades of our life. Daniel, welcome to the Commonwealth Club, and let's talk about your new book.
Thank you. Well, Allison, this is just such a treat for me because I was a student when we first met 30
That's
years
right.
ago, and I just have devoured all of your articles, peer-reviewed articles in particular, and your books, and the opportunity to talk to you about this topic, I mean, of you're not aging. You look the same as you did 30 years ago. But whatever you're doing, it's successful. So I'm looking forward to learning from you and sharing.
Yeah, my one aperçu about aging is that everything about it is great about getting older, except waking up and finding you're in the body of a cockroach. That's the only downside.
Yeah, my mom says that. She's 85. And she says, she looks in the mirror and she says, who is that old lady? I feel like I'm 20 inside.
Well, we all have that person inside of us.
Yeah.
But I guess that really raises the first sort of question, which is, you and I aren't that old, but even so, from an evolutionary perspective, why are we here, right? I mean, if we were chimps, then we would have been dead for 15 years. And
if we were born 500 years ago.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, though. I mean, even 500 years ago, some people at least, were living until they were 70.
Absolutely.
And that's a big difference between us and our closest primate relatives. Yeah. Why is that? Why do we have this extra, even in hunter-gatherer cultures, we have this extra 20 years tacked on to the end? And of course, it's particularly vivid for women because we're the only species except for orcas who have a period after menopause. So why is that? Why are we here?
Well, I'm persuaded by some of the things you've written about this that part of it is the grandparent syndrome. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, to my understanding as an outsider, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, of course, but I'm just a simple country neuroscientist. But for the love of God, Jim. I see it as part and parcel of the idea of why do we have gay people? One of the prevailing theories is that gay people help contribute to the raising of the family, and so in that way are indirectly helping to promote the genes that their siblings carry and other family members. And grandparents are helping to promote the genes. It's somewhat diluted by the time you get to a grandchild. But they are serving an important function. They're certainly 50,000 or so years that humans have been on the planet. We didn't have written language for most of that time. And so you had some sort of family and institutional memory with grandparents and wisdom. We know that as brains get older, one of the things that happens is older adults are better at certain kinds of problem solving and at wisdom, which is a form of problem solving. So what are your thoughts on the grandparent syndrome?
Yeah, well, I mean, aside from the fact that my one piece of practical advice as a developmental psychologist to everyone is skip the children, go straight to the grandchildren.
Have you figured out how to do that?
I think there's actually a lot of evidence and increasing evidence that that it really was having those grandparents, the grandmothers and grandfathers, who just gave that extra support to children. And as you mentioned, we're one of the few cultural species, and great older people seem to serve this function of passing on the wisdom.
Cultural transmission.
Cultural transmission, passing on the wisdom of what's happened before. And as you were saying before we started, whales turn out to be really interesting from that perspective. Do you want to say more about how do whales fit into this picture, or actually orcas?
I think you should say more about it. This is your work, really.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we know is orcas are the only other species that we know of that has postmenopausal grandmothers. And just in the past year or two, there's been all these fabulous studies that have come out that have shown that the grandmothers are actually leading the pods of whales to foraging resources that they might have found out about a long time ago. Do you think there's something about human brains as they get older that might be relevant to this idea of passing on culture or giving wisdom? Is there something you can see in the brain that seems to be designed to help us do that?
Well, I guess we could back up a minute and ask what it is we mean by wisdom. Mm-hmm. What is wisdom? I do devote some of the book to trying to figure that out. And there are cognitive scientists who study wisdom and try to define it. And I think just as a simple working definition, wisdom is the ability to see patterns in behaviors or events that might elude other people, see commonalities among different events, disparate events, and be able to predict outcomes of different courses of action better than others. And I think that the kind of wisdom that we value as a society necessarily involves empathy and compassion and solving interpersonal problems. Now, for reasons we don't understand, there are neurostructural and neurochemical reasons that cause older adults to become more compassionate, to experience more gratitude. There's some hypotheses about why this might be, but we don't really know. And then, of course, pattern matching. You know, when I talk about extracting commonalities across different experiences, that's pattern matching. It's pulling patterns out of things. And pattern matching gets better the more time you spend doing it, the more experiences you've had, the more able you are to say, oh, this is just like that. I mean, in our own recent history, there's a kind of a divide among the generations of people who have lived through an impeachment and people who haven't. And it means something very different to the two people, right? Two impeachments or near impeachments, if you count Nixon, right?
Right.
So didn't actually go to impeachment, but, you know, he resigned under the threat of it. And, you know, youngsters, the millennials who were experiencing this for the first time, the ones I talked to are kind of freaking out. You know, country's falling apart. Well, it may be. But older adults say, well, you know, it didn't fall apart under the other two. So the gratitude and the compassion certainly help with the wisdom, but the pattern matching as a cognitive neuroscientist what interests me. Mm-hmm. And if you'll indulge me, I have a kind of personal story about, that has a San Francisco focus. My grandfather was an immigrant and came here in 1901 his whole family were tradespeople. Nobody had been to college, of course, but he decided as the seventh of eight children, he wanted to go to college. And he worked a full-time job and put himself through UC Berkeley. And he got his bachelor's degree when he was 21. And he then decided he wanted to go to medical school, which was part of the UC Berkeley campus. He worked two jobs to put himself through medical school. And he got his degree, one of the first ones awarded in this country, in this newfangled field called radiology. And he couldn't get a job at a regular hospital because the regular hospitals wouldn't hire Jewish doctors. Right. So he got a job at Mount Zion Hospital, which is now incorporated into UCSF up on Divisadero. He worked there his whole career, and they asked him to found the Department of Radiology there and to chair it. My father was born there. I was born there. I mean, this is a hospital with a deep family history. And he also died in that hospital because of ageism, effectively. When he was 62, the very department that he had built and the young people he had hired decided that at 62 he was irrelevant and in the way and of no use to them anymore. There were no complaints about him. He was publishing in medical journals, peer-reviewed radiology journals. He was seeing a full patient load. But 62 just seemed too old. And the irony is that radiology is nothing if it's not pattern matching.
Right, right.
It's looking at little shadows on pieces of film and trying to figure out, is this shadow a tumor or not? And if it's a tumor, is it cancerous or not? And if you've done this thousands of times and then seen the clinical outcomes, had the patients come back and seen the results, your pattern matching peaks at maybe 80, not 62. And the tragedy is that after being pushed out, he sunk into a depression. And we know that depression depletes your immune system. And he died at that hospital of an infection, basically, that he normally would have been able to fight off.
Hmm. Yeah. So that raises another kind of question, which I've thought about, and we probably have all thought about recently, which is it true that it seems like 70-year-olds are running the world to a great extent? Is that
and running for president?
And running for president. And you could have feelings about that both ways. So what do you think the neuroscience would tell us about what it means to be 70 now as opposed to, say, what it meant to be 70 in the past or what it means to be 70 in other kinds of contexts?
Well, so this is really the best time in history to be 70.
Yeah. It's I saw, by the way, a wonderful New Yorker cartoon that I liked that said, death is the new 80, which I kind of...
So, you know, you've heard people say 60 is the new 40, 80 is the new 60. The reality is that we are living longer, but not just longer, we're living healthier.
Yeah.
Far healthier. And 70-year-olds are doing things that 50-year-olds used to do, and they're doing them well. We've eradicated, through medical science and technology, you know, most of the things that killed us 100 years ago, 50 years ago. And we have, you know, generally speaking, healthier lifestyles. Not in all cases, but generally speaking. And what's happening neurally is that, for one thing, there are a number of myths. For one thing, the myth of declining memory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people have failing memory as they get older. And indeed, it's a marker of Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's is rarer than we think it is. Hmm. We've seen an increased number of diagnoses of Alzheimer's, and the majority of those, according to many studies, are misdiagnoses. Hmm. They're misdiagnosed people are having memory impairment based on lack of sleep, or disrupted sleep, or based on polypharmacy, the mixture of a different large number of medications that cause memory side effects. But for the majority of adults, they can experience no memory impairment through their 70s, 80s, and 90s at all, coupled with increased empathy, compassion, tolerance, increased problem-solving abilities, particularly in the social domain. And to me, that's a recipe for somebody who's poised to actually be able to make better decisions on average than a younger counterpart. But I hasten to add that the social psychological literature is rich, as is the business literature, with examples of the most productive teams being those that are inclusive of gender, of race, country of national origin, background, educational background, and age.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. As a developmental psychologist, one of the things that I think, is a very natural way of thinking about human development. I spend most of my time actually at the other end of the spectrum studying babies and young children. And there's a tendency, why would this be? There's a tendency to think that sort of a 40-year-old white male psychologist is like the peak of human achievement, right? And everybody else is just sort of either trying to get up to that level or else falling off from that level one way or another. And of course, from an evolutionary perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And instead of thinking about development as if it's this, you know, getting up to this peak and then having a decline, it makes much more sense to think that these different developmental periods are really serving different evolutionary and cognitive functions. So from the other end, one of the things that I've argued and others have argued is instead of thinking about children as being these kind of defective grown-ups who don't have the same kinds of abilities as grown-ups, we should think about them as being like, you know, a different phase of development with different kinds of strengths that are complementary to the strengths.
Well, I think that,
and I think the same argument could be made about, say, that post 50 to 70. Postmenopausal period. In fact, I think there's an argument to be made that we're actually really only human up till puberty and after menopause, or the equivalent for men. And in between, we're sort of like super baboons. Like, we're really completely these driven creatures that are out there desperately trying to maximize our resources and our utilities. And up till then, we're exploring and we're figuring out how the world works and we're learning and playing. And it sort of feels like after that, we're trying to encourage other people, providing a kind of generosity to the next generation, that sense of urgent purpose about, you know, we need to mate and we need to reproduce and we need to get resources, that calms down. I wonder what you think about the happiness literature, which is really interesting and sort of counterintuitive in terms of aging.
Yeah, so I do see older age as just another developmental stage. It's not just decline, which has been the societal narrative. And with this conversation that we're having, and with this book and this radio broadcast, my overarching goal is that we can change the societal narrative, society-wide, about what it means to be an older adult. It's not just a time of decline and debilitation and sadness. It's another developmental stage, like toddlerhood, infancy, toddlerhood, pre-adolescence, adolescence, young adulthood, middle age. It's another distinct phase with some advantages, some strengths, some challenges. We've seen a number of examples, just as you say, of people who kind of kick into high gear after menopause or andropause and become their best selves and experience the peak of meaningfulness in their lives and relevancy. And it turns out across 72 different countries, tens of thousands of people surveyed, what do you all suppose the peak age of happiness across a lifetime is? It's 82. So if you're not 82 yet, and I'm looking around the room, I think that's all of you, you got quite a bit to look forward to. And if you are 82, I think that, you know, it's ageism that's making it that. We can push it out another 10 or 20 years.
And in fact, the way the curve seems to go is that you're basically happy when you're a child, and somewhere in your 20s or 30s, happiness sort of starts to decline. I think it's like 47 is the nadir.
Yes.
I was thinking about when you and I were both in that age range, we both can relate to that. But then the remarkable thing is around 50, the curve starts to go back up again and keeps going until the, you know, until you get sick, and getting sick sucks, but until you get to the getting sick part, you seem to be getting happier.
It's true. And you know, that in compiling the research for the book, I found just so many stories of people that inspired me. People who, to put it another way, have kind of rewritten the story of their life, their own biography, at a later age. Have you heard of... This is my new hero.
Yeah.
Do you know about Julia Hurricane Hawkins?
No.
So she's a retired school teacher from Baton Rouge. She's a 103-year-old competitive runner who just took gold medals in the senior games, broke two world's records this year for running at 103. She didn't begin competitive sports until age 75 and didn't begin running until age 100. So, or Carmen Herrera, a painter in New York City, who didn't sell her first painting until age 81 and then kept painting up a storm and was ignored for another 8 years. She continues to paint at 104. In fact, I tried to interview her and her people said, "I'm sorry, she's too busy." And her works now hang in the Whitney.
Well, what do you think about, you know, there's a notion in art that, thinking about a painter reminded me, and in literature, of a kind of late style. So if you think about Beethoven's quartets, for example, I mean, that's an example of late style. Do you think there's connections between that and the things that people usually think of as late style is a kind of depth and a kind of profundity and even a kind of austerity that you don't see in earlier work? Do you think that's connected with some of these changes in the brain?
It was certainly true of Elliot Carter, the composer, who said it took me 80 years to learn who Elliot Carter was. You know, what I find in the arts, and I know more about music than the other arts.
That's right. So, you know, you've written that wonderful book about music. How about music? I remember going to see Sonny Rollins when he was in his 80s, and he was spectacular.
I just talked to him recently. Interviewed him for the book. Wonderful. 89 years old, possibly the greatest living jazz musician on the planet. He played with everybody, you know, all the people who he's outlived. I've come to see that in art and maybe in life, there are two kinds of people. There are people who keep pushing to try new things, who are curious about the world, open to having new experiences. And, you know, Miles Davis is an example from music. He was never content to just rest on his laurels. Now, a lot of people don't like the later work as much as the earlier work, but that is the mark of an artist, that he was looking for something new. Joni Mitchell, constantly trying to reinvent herself to the point that her record label sued her for making records that weren't Joni Mitchell-like. And Sonny continued to push boundaries. He's got an ailment now that doesn't allow him to play, a lung disease. But he's loving his immersion into the study of Zen Buddhism. Paul Simon, who is, I think, the best example among well-known musicians, he started making a series of albums in the year 2000, starting with a record called You're the One. And that series of records since then, in the last 20 years, I think were among the best records of his career, and each one got better and better. And they were selling less and less, but that didn't bother him. We did an event together like this, a conversation, and he was just saying he's always just wanted to find out what new things he could try. That's a real artist. And he's very curious and open. And I'm using these terms because they come from individual differences psychology. Right. From your colleague and mine, Oliver John and Lou Goldberg. And it turns out that these two qualities, curiosity and openness, are neuroprotective. As you age, if you can maintain them, which can be hard to do because there are neural changes that make you want to just not try new things, neurochemical and neurostructural changes. But like Dylan Thomas says, you know, rage. Do not go quietly into that good night. Rage against the complacency of not doing anything and pushing back. And the good news on this is that if you're not particularly curious or open, you can change. You can change at any age. You're not too young to start. You're never too old to start. The entire field of psychotherapy is based on the idea that you can change your personality. as is meditation, Buddhism, yoga, all of these. There's no one path that works for everybody, and interestingly, drugs. We find that giving what might be called a subclinical dose, a less than normal minimal dose of antidepressants, actually awakens the dopaminergic system, and dopamine is the neurochemical that makes you curious. It makes you want to explore. Teenagers probably have too much of it. The production of it declines as we get older, but you can boost it.
So that's another question. I mean, given that it seems as if we have all these examples of people who for whom age is, later life is a, in some ways, maybe the best period of their lives, what are things that people could do, or even more that we could do as a society that would make a difference? And I'll mention one. I was on the stage talking to Mark Friedman with the Commonwealth Club a little while ago, and he's talked about the fact that if we have this evolutionary function of taking care of young people, there's a very strange thing that we do in our society, which no society has ever done before, which is segregate out old people from children, for example. And I think there's a lot of evidence that taking care of young children is actually, this gets back to how fantastic it is to be a grandmother, is something that is not just good for young children, but also good for older people themselves. What are some other things that we could do in institutionally, maybe as much as personally, to allow more people to experience aging in this very positive way from a
young people, when asked to describe older adults, if they haven't spent much time with them, in a free response, they use words like miserable, curmudgeonly, grumpy, ailing, in pain. Some use the word smelly. But after interacting with them in meaningful ways, such as an intergenerational choir, or a kind of trade program where, you know, Allison and I are both Canadian, and Toronto has been at the forefront of intergenerational housing units.
Yeah.
Where dormitory college students are placed with older adults in a kind of adult community, but it's an adult and younger people community, and they interact. The college kids might change the light bulbs for the older adults, or help them with their phones, and the older adults might tutor them in things that they had specialized in, or just be companions, talk to them, book groups, things like that. Again, I think the societal narrative needs to change, and it changes by us interacting with one another. Mm-hmm. It's the same way that we have been able to address the terrible societal bigotry against people of particular races or gender identities. The more we interact with people who are different from us, the more we realize they're not different from us. They're really the same.
Yeah, and in some ways, particularly in this issue about age, there's this kind of complementarity. So there's a lovely study that I love by an anthropologist named Polly Wiesner, and she looked in some of these forager cultures, and she looked at what people talked about during the day, and then what happened at night when everyone sat around the fire. And again, this is part of my feeling about that's when we're human. And what she discovered was during the day, it was the middle-aged people who were basically running the show and doing most of the talking and arranging work, and mostly there was a category called CCC, complaint, criticism, and conflict, mostly kvetching about the fact that other people weren't working enough. But when the sun went down...
It's nice that you can reduce the three C's to a K.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But when the sun went down, suddenly things shifted, and now it was the older people and the children who were sort of the stars of the show, and the older people were telling stories. They were talking about what happened a long time ago. They were passing on the myths and songs of the culture, and the little kids were sitting around the fire and eating it all up.
Older adults and young kids have a very special relationship, and not just in the family, but I have to say, what really shaped the book for me and the wanting to write it was these very intense personal experiences that life just delivered to me. Mm-hmm. you know, in developmental science, we talk about the triad of genes, culture, and opportunity as being the three things that influence the course of one's life. And opportunity is just the dumb things that happen, or, you know, the random things, not always dumb. And my very first encounter with an older adult, I grew up across in the East Bay in Moraga, when it was not a suburb, it was farmland. It was mostly cows grazing and pear and walnut orchards, and it wasn't incorporated, but there was an old Pony Express stop that was a post office, and the U.S. Postal Service required that there be a postmaster, and they picked the person who had been in the town the longest, who was a 75-year-old woman named Eleanor Dickinson, who was sort of like the town mayor or town grandparent. And I met her when I was six and used to go over to her house, and she would teach me about nature. She had salamanders in her backyard, and she taught me to identify the different kinds, and she'd make me hot cocoa and cookies, and it was a really warm and loving relationship. And when I was a student, I had the great opportunity, it just happened that way, Irv Rock.
Yeah, that's right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
Right.
Maybe you could say a word about Irv Rock, and then I'll talk about how that came about.
Yeah, so Irv Rock was a wonderful, profoundly brilliant psychologist who moved to Berkeley late in life and was a kind of mentor both for Daniel and for me. A wonderful example of an incredibly brilliant and incredibly nice man, which doesn't always go together.
Big-hearted guy. One of the most profound thinkers in what we would call the study of perception. And every time I go to Google or Apple and the machine learning groups there, I see his book on the shelf. I mean, this is profound stuff. And, you know, we just developed a bond over Reuben sandwiches and pickles. And I was very lucky to have him and many, many other people, 40 or 50 years my senior, throughout my life, as well as my grandparents, who I have to say, I'm lucky to say, they doted on me in a way that most parents don't, because they're in the middle of their careers and doing things. And you had this wonderful aspect of opportunity in your own household. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd share how you think that played out, because you come from a very famous Montreal family.
Well, I come from a big, noisy Montreal family, is the way I would put it. But
you can say that, I can't.
It is very interesting now to see. So I come from a family of six, and of the six, three of the sisters just became grandparents in the past 2 or 3 years. So it's kind of an amazing thing to suddenly have all of us be in this new role. And we're all basically very happy about how sweet and nice and bright the other grandchildren are. I mean, they're not quite exactly like ours, but they're very nice, and we like spending time with them.
You have Augie.
Yes.
I mean, that's a special.
In fact, I was rushing to get here because I was taking Augie to math class. But it turns out that one of the things that's so fascinating about that role is that, you know, being a mother, for example, there's all this kind of hormonal preparation, and there's all this kind of background. And I mean, after all, it is your baby. And, you know, even being a father, there's this kind of really enormous change. And the striking thing about being older is that you can, and this sounds sentimental, but I think it's true, is that there's a kind of love that you can feel for a child that has a real depth very, very quickly, and a real kind of generosity to it that's really different from the kinds of emotions that you have.
Well, I think that's the compassion and the empathy. And so, you know, an interesting thing is The Dalai Lama had sent over some of his monks to various centers to have their brains scanned. And we found certain differences in functional scans of the brain for people who had been meditating for 20 years, particularly on compassion and gratitude meditation, which are the two focused meditations that the Dalai Lama recommends. And we see those the activation in those same regions in grandparents, mm-hmm. who, whether they ever meditated or not, they kind of naturally slip into this feeling of gratitude and compassion and acceptance. A parent might accept a child's behavior less than a grandparent would accept it because the parent's trying to mold the child. The grandparent is less so trying to mold the child, I think, than to inspire the child and to give a context for cultural and family history and values education. In my family, anyway, the values always came down from the grandparents more than the parents. And, you know, we talk a lot about what kind of world are the boomers leaving to our children. I think an equally important conversation for us older adults to have, for we older adults to have, is what kind of children are we leaving the world?
Let's take some questions from the audience. I like this. This is combining both of your areas of expertise. Which genre of music would you recommend for 70-year-olds, classical or hip-hop, in the context of making you smarter and more open and more compassionate and empathetic?
You're trying to get me into trouble, whoever asked that. I think that the big thing is, if you've been a music listener all along, try doing something different. Yeah. Immerse yourself in dance or in visual art or in literature, some other art form that you haven't devoted as much time to, because that's the kind of that the newness of the experience creates entirely new neural connections, pathways that are expanding your repertoire of the kinds of things that you engage with, and that's neurally protective. I think it's probably helpful to listen to hip hop, in that it's been around for 40 years now.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's here to stay, and it is what has resonance for young kids. And, you know, it's funny, my parents could not stand that noise I listened to in my bedroom all those years. To them, The Who and Hendrix and Cream and Blood, Sweat and Tears and The Beatles and The Carpenters all sounded alike. And now in their 80s, they've been buying up Carpenters and Beatles and Who records, and they finally come around.
I mean, again, to get back to some of these societal questions, one of the other questions is, you know, what would you say about the idea that there's this kind of graying of America that's going on? So there really are these demographic shifts such that, well, in America and in Europe and throughout the world.
Japan.
And Japan may be a kind of leading edge example of this. There's societies with more and more older people. Are there things that we can do, that we should do, that we should think about in terms of, you know, what would be a policy position that you could have about this?
Well, just to share some statistics, this is the first year in history when there are more Americans over 65 than under 5.
Hmm.
And within 10 years, there'll be more Americans over 65 than under 18.
Hmm.
So you may have heard the expression that children are our future. They're not. Old people are. Lots of them. And the thing that I found over and over again in from talking to people and from reading the literature is that if I have one piece of advice, it's don't retire.
Hmm.
And if you do retire, maybe because you're in a job that's stressful or dangerous or you get forced out, like my grandfather, retire to something else. Volunteer work, work in a hospital, work in an old age home for people who might be your age but aren't mobile. Any kind of philanthropic activity or tutoring. The societal issue is, you know, we talk a lot about the stress on the Social Security system. If you don't retire, you're still contributing to it. Mm-hmm. You're paying income tax rather than drawing from the economy. And there's no medical or neurological reason why people can't be working in their 80s and 90s. And universities are a really great example of that. Mm-hmm. I saw Dan Slobin the other day. How old is Dan?
He's in his 80s anyway, yeah.
He's as sharp as he was 40 years ago. Yeah. My own teacher, Roger Shepard, is now 91. I talk to him on the phone now and then. He's working on two different books, one about physics, which is not his area. He's a psychologist. Another about the free will problem. Basically, do we have free will or not? Mike Posner is in his, I think Mike Posner, another one of my mentors, 86, 87. He's still collaborating with Mary Rothbart, who unfortunately, developmental psychologist, about the same age. Unfortunately, she's been bedridden for 2 or 3 years with a physical ailment, but she's still working. So
that raises another question. I mean, we've been being very optimistic about the fact that the fact that we have this potential to continue to be both physically and mentally active. But it is, you know, it is also true that, death is the new 80. It is also true that we're going to have to be, people as they get older are going to have to be facing these kinds of challenges of mobility and of health and eventually facing the end. I was going to say, I do think one of the things that happens is that as it's this curious and kind of moving thing, which is, as you know that there's less time ahead, the time that you have seems to take on extra value. I think that's part of the difference between the grandparents' experience of the grandchildren, which has this kind of funny, almost meditative quality. You know, it's being very present in the moment with those children as opposed to thinking every minute about what's going to happen in the future. And I think having a sense of that there's not infinite time left has some of those effects. But what should we do about all the other things, the things that are real and that we shouldn't be closing our eyes about the negative sides of getting older? I mean,
Right. I mean, you can't keep working if you're not able to work. I think part of what we can do is start having frank conversations with our loved ones, our children, our partners, our doctors, about what we want our time to look like. There are a number of choices that can be made, trade-offs. Do you want to live longer or do you want to live healthier? Mm-hmm. So in the book, I make the distinction between your, you talk about the lifespan from when you're born to when you die, you can distinguish it as having a health span and a disease span, as Allison said. You know, mm-hmm. Most of us, we go sailing along. We're healthy, healthy, healthy. We get sick, we die. And there's a lot of most of the research on longevity is looked at making your life longer without looking at all about what that last part is going to be like. It's just extending the years, extending the clock. I argue in the book that we should be extending the health span. Mm-hmm. And sure, if you get a greater lifespan out of it, that's great. But what would be the point in living to 200 years if you spend the last 110 unaware of your surroundings and stricken with Alzheimer's? So what we can do is start having conversations about these trade-offs. Mm-hmm. I know some older adults who have decided they would rather stay mentally active longer. And there are certain cognitive enhancing drugs you can take. I'm not talking about anything crazy. I'm not talking about illegal drugs, but they might slightly increase the risk of heart disease. So the question is, you know, where do you want to draw the line? And then I think we can, I just took my uncle to see an assisted living facility. Actually, it's a senior living community with an assisted living component up in Napa. He's not ready, but he had read the book and he decided it would be a good idea to get used to the idea and just to see what it was like. And I got to tell you, we had so much fun there. We were both ready to sign on the dotted line. So I think, you know, part of it is to do what Danny Kahneman calls the pre-mortem.
Yeah.
Think about what could go wrong. Think about what your life might be like. And start exploring it in your mind and in conversations, so that when the time comes, it doesn't come as a shock. Fill out an advanced medical directive. There's also an advanced dementia directive, which I have in the book. Things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's important is to think not in terms of when you're, you know, there's an interest in life extension. And I had a conversation with a young man at Google when I was there once, and he was saying he thought all of the people in the Valley really wanted to have these new ways of making your life longer, getting rid of mortality. And I said to him, well, you know, like you have children and you have relationships and you have spouses and, you know, even as you see yourself not existing, you have a sense of yourself going on in your children and the people that you love. And he said,
students,
exactly. And he said, would that be kind of like having to get a girlfriend? And I said, yeah, I think that would be like a good first step. And he said he thought just figuring out how to be immortal was probably easier. It wasn't as difficult, and would be a better getting some technological fixes for death would be a better, easier route than having to get a girlfriend.
Fascinating. Totally illogical.
One of the other questions here that I think also speaks to this is, what is it about, say, classical and jazz musicians? This gets back to your point about retiring. That seems to enable so many musicians to keep functioning into a really late into age. It's funny. I was just watching the Ken Burns country music series, and it seems like great musicians either sort of die when they're 25 or live until they're 90, making great music.
Well, one of the things is that playing music, whether you write it or not, just playing music uses every part of the brain we've so far mapped.
Hmm.
It's one of the most complex human activities there is. In many respects, more complex than being a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon. I worked in a medical school at McGill, and I can tell you, brain surgery is not that complicated. It's mostly plumbing. You know, stop a leak here, you know, drain some fluid there. I think part of it is that it's so engaging for the brain, and part of it is the culture of musicians, is that musicians often, typically, are encountering new people all the time and playing with new people. And think about it, the very thing that makes new people exciting also makes them annoying.
Mm-hmm.
They may disagree with you. They may not negotiate or compromise with you. I mean, all of us who have ever worked in a workplace, I'm sure you've had coworkers that you just did not like. One of the reasons I say don't retire is that when you retire, you don't have to deal with people you don't like. And dealing with people you don't like is healthy for the brain. It requires a lot of accommodation, as does playing music. You've got to pay attention to what the other person is doing. You can't make music effectively if you're not. You've got to know when your part's going to fit in. You've got to be keeping a sense of timing. Music is a conversation.
So it's interesting, you know, Laura Carstensen, who you know, has talked about there's a sort of tension, though, right? Because on the one hand, it's important for older people to be engaged. But on the other hand, there is a sense in which there's a kind of pruning that goes on as people get older, where the people who they're close to become more and more important to them, and they spend more time with them. And there's a kind of sense of priorities about what really counts. And how do you think those two things get balanced?
Well, so Laura calls this socio-emotional selectivity theory.
Right.
And it was based on some really groundbreaking work that she did during the AIDS crisis here in San Francisco. which is she noticed that people who were given a death sentence, you're going to live only 6 months or a year, reshifted the way they wanted to spend their time to look effectively more like 80 and 85-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And what she found is that the way you want to spend your time is in large degree, and it's been replicated many, many times the world over, it's to a large degree influenced by how much time you have left. Hmm. And so there's this tendency as we get older, you know, one sort of broad way of painting the entire lifespan is that, you know, in the early years, you're just acquiring the tools you need, language, manners, potty training. And then you acquire knowledge in school and in intermediate and high school, social knowledge, hopefully. And then you develop skills, you get a job, you try to acquire resources, as you were saying, so that you can have resources for your family, potentially for your retirement. And in your 20s, you're looking for new experiences, trying to figure out who you are. What kind of person do I want to spend time with? What kind of job do I want to spend time on? By the time you hit 50 or 60, you figured that out. You're less inclined to want to try new things. You want to go to the restaurant that you know will give you a good meal.
Right.
Not to some newfangled restaurant with yak ears, you know, parboiled in beef lungs. You know, you want to have this this safety net. And by the same token, you want to go to that restaurant with people that you know make you feel good about yourself and that you have a commitment to. But to some extent, we need to push back against that.
Uh-huh.
I recommend the next time you're in line at the grocery store.
The yak ears? Go for the yak ears? Is that what you're suggesting, Dan?
No. But speaking of ears, try to get the ear of the person in the line next to you.
Mm-hmm.
Just start up a conversation. There's a lot of research that shows that people who are riding the subway or the bus or standing in line, really, if asked, they'll say, no, I don't want to talk to anybody. But if forced to, they actually like it. Mm-hmm. And I find that I have a better sense of community and belonging in the world when I talk to strangers on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I had this extraordinary experience 2 weeks ago. I was in New York City, and I was waiting for the F train with my friend Peter Himmelman, who has been studying Jewish mysticism. And the thing he's been studying for many years now is to love your fellow human, which is sometimes hard to do. And it's 10 o'clock at night. There's an F train that we're waiting for, and this homeless person comes up to us. And in the spectrum of homelessness people, some are more uncomfortable to be around than others, right? And this person was on the far end of uncomfortable. He had peed his pants. Mm. He was in clothing that had not, you know, dirt and blood caked on it. And he had a bead of fresh mucus stuck in his mustache halfway up his nose still. And he walked towards us. And I don't care how compassionate you are. I think most people at that point would kind of turn away. But not Peter. Peter leaned in towards him. The guy came up and started talking. We couldn't hear him. But Peter looked at him intently and with acceptance and compassion in Peter's face. And the guy kept talking. And Peter said at one point, "Sir, I can't hear your words, but I feel them." And the guy just suddenly, everything about him changed. Peter asked him his name. His name was Dyrell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were just coming from a gig, so Peter took out my guitar, and he said, "Dyrell, I'd like to play a song for you." And Peter improvised this amazing song with really exotic chord changes and rhymes. It started out rather simple. "We're here waiting for the F train. I met a man named Dyrell. I can see from his face that things are not going well." And he kept using Dyrell's name in the song and making it about the moment there. Dyrell looked like a 6-year-old. He was so happy. He looked like a kid in kindergarten who was being praised by the teacher, because that's what you do for every child in turn in kindergarten, right? You let them be the center of attention. It was amazing. And then Peter started to sing, and I can see, he moved into a chorus. He says, I can see that you are a man. Dyrell is a man with dignity, though not everyone sees it.
Mm-hmm.
I lost it. I was so moved. And Dyrell was transformed. He walked away with this bounce in his step. For a moment at least, I don't know how long it lasted, he was not just what we ignore. He was a man. He was a human. And ever since then, I've been trying to talk to homeless people as I go through the city and not be afraid of them. And some of them are not sensical, but they still want to be heard. And I don't know how to solve the homelessness problem, but I know that by opening my heart to this thing that I've tried to shut out for so long, I feel more human.
Mm. So I think, you know, that raises an interesting question again. I mean, we've been emphasizing successful aging, but I guess one question is how do you let go of some things and let other things and emphasize the things that actually really count. So, you know, giving things to the next generation, for example, being able to step back. It, as you know, the academic world that we both come from is one where you have wonderful examples. My old mentor, Jerome Bruner, lived to be 100 and was incredibly active and involved and engaged all the way through. But we also
know Brenda Milner just turned 100.
Yeah. So there's another maybe being a neuroscientist is a good strategy for an old age. But we also know about people where we feel like they hung on too long. They hung on after they could have been more gracefully making room for younger people and younger ideas.
Well, this is delicate. So what Posner and Shepard did, my two mentors, is they retired. I actually retired from McGill.
Yeah.
I retired because not because I didn't want to contribute anymore, but because by doing so, the department could hire a 30-year-old.
Yeah.
And I didn't lose any of my rights and privileges as a McGill professor by retiring. I mean, I'm emeritus, so I still have a lab there, and I still have grants, and I still supervise students. But a younger person has come in. That person who came in, I mentored and gave them some guidance, and I still serve on doctoral committees. And so I think it's a modifying of the role. I didn't quite get out of the way. Nobody asked me to. I think they would if they thought I was clogging the works.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the things that generations do is they enable societal change. So, you know, we know that what happens with each generation is that the kinds of values that people have or the things that seemed completely like just part of life for us, women, for example, 20 years ago, that look as if they're intolerable now, or vice versa, things that seemed completely unimaginable then that seem commonplace now. And I think it's quite an interesting question with generations. This is, we were talking a little before about, you know, the whole hey boomer phenomenon, our relationship to all those damn avocado toast eating millennials.
Have you had avocado toast?
I love avocado toast, I will admit, and I feed it to my grandchildren. But I mean, I think there are these interesting questions. In some sense, that older generation becomes the repository of the cultural wisdom, like the, you know, orca, those postmenopausal orca grandmothers going out and finding the salmon. But and we wouldn't want to be giving that up for the sake of the new generation. And yet there's this productive tension between the fact that we have a certain kind of tradition and a certain kind of knowledge, and then the fact that we know that we're passing that information on. You can see this in technological change, for example, which is something that I've thought about quite a lot. There's a lot of anxiety about what's happening with technological change. And almost always what happens is, you know, basically the day before you're born is Eden and the day after your children are born is Mad Max. We sort of assume that things are going to get worse and the next generation isn't going to be as good as the previous generation. I did a column about this recently in the Wall Street Journal. This is something that a bunch of psychologists called the kids these days effect. So I think it's an interesting challenge. Like, how could we avoid the kids these days effect? Or should we avoid it? Maybe we just embrace the kids these days effect.
I think, again, it's a societal conversation. We have to, as older adults, we have to talk about it among ourselves, but also with younger adults. We have to find a way to work together. Look, the biggest problems that we're facing in the world, however you want to list them, but I mean, they'd include things like an unequal distribution of resources, you know, large proportion of the world not having clean water, terrible aggressions within countries and across countries, climate change. If these problems were easy to solve, they would have been solved already. I don't think we boomers are going to solve them, but I don't think the millennials are going to solve them either. I think we need to work together. And it is hard to figure out what these partnerships will look like. But as one example that has another local angle just up the street here, as you know, Stephen Coslin and I left our university positions.
Right. Yeah, that's a good example.
I left McGill, Stephen left Stanford, he'd been at Harvard before, and we joined with somebody almost half our age, Ben Nelson, an entrepreneur, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, and we started a new university that was based on the newest technology. We created a technological platform that uses the science of learning, 40 years of the science of learning from cognitive psychology that rarely gets put into the classroom. And it was only possible because Ben knew that he needed from Stephen and I and now Vicky Chandler and other older adults who were working on the project, including Diane Halpern. He knew that he needed our collected, you know, together we had like 200 years of experience in college ed, right? Ben knew he needed that, but he also hired the top engineers and computer scientists from Silicon Valley to implement this cross-generational view of what education can look like. And we now have students from over 60 countries. Most of them are on financial aid because we're need-blind in our admissions. And by all accounts, we are providing a better education than any other institution. I mean, by actual metrics.
Yeah, I mean, universities are among the oldest institutions in the world, right?
And they're slow to change.
And they're very slow to change. So there's an example. And it seems like there's a sort of picture there's a picture about having different developmental periods interacting both for individual people and in general. But if there were three things that you were going to recommend to people, what are the things they should be thinking about as they're going into this period of age?
Well, I have two sets of three things, really.
Okay.
One is if things are going well, the things to think about, and then if things aren't going well, the things to think about.
Right.
So things are going well for you. The first one, I'll just reiterate, don't retire, or if you retire from something, make sure you have something to retire to, and sitting in a corner stamp collecting is probably not it. Work on your conscientiousness if you're not a conscientious person. That is the biggest single statistical factor that predicts longevity. Conscientious people don't get run over by a bus as often because they don't cross against the light. They don't end up in prison because they follow rules. They go see the doctor when something's wrong. They actually have a doctor to see. And, you know, like anything else, you can change your personality if you want to. So increasing conscientiousness. And then finally, I'd say if you're doing well, get in the habit of trying to be more open and curious. Mm. Now, if you're not doing well and you're thinking about moving into a retirement community or something, or, you know, whatever change of living. I know a lot of older adults talk about wanting to leave the city and get out to the country where it's quiet and beautiful. But there are some very practical questions that you should ask yourself. One of them is, and these are sort of whimsical stand-ins for the real issue. One of them is, who will change my light bulbs? If you're living 40 miles out in the country and you're 80 years old, do you really want to be climbing a ladder to get to those recessed bulbs, or, you know, calling somebody in who's going to take, you know, 40 minutes or an hour to get to your place? Who's going to change my light bulb? Who's going to help me out with things that I need help with? Carry my groceries, whatever it is. The second one is, what do I do if I want to get an ice cream cone? Which is a proxy for, wherever you're living, can you be spontaneous? Can you just get up and walk somewhere and do something fun without having to rely on a car if you might get to the point where you can't drive, or having to depend on an Uber and all of that, or Lyft or other rideshare program? I do not endorse any particular rideshare program. And third, who am I going to have lunch with? How are you going to spend your time with other people? Maybe you'll start a reading group or a, you know, book club or a bridge club, or just go out to lunch. But you have to make an effort to get out of the house and mix with people, particularly young people when you're older.
So hang out with your grandchildren. That sounds like that's a good...
Or in my case...
Or other people's grandchildren.
Right, exactly, in my case.
Well, we're just about out of time, so... Let me give a huge thank you to Daniel Levitin, the author of yet another bestseller, Successful Aging. I'm Allison Gopnik, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. And I get to take the gavel.